From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report for the 13th day of November 2019. I'm Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Jackie Vick. She's from Stuart Peterson. A bit later in the program, Rich Nelson, who's the chief strategist at Allendale, will be here to go through the numbers that they released earlier today, a survey of farmers across the United States and what their expectations for acreage might be in the coming year. And then as we close out our time together, we'll talk about the weather forecast. It remains ugly if you're in the High Plains, the Dakotas, and all parts of Minnesota as well. Drew Lerner will be here from World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City to explain the impact on the livestock sector. It all happens on this Wednesday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. Look us up, listen to us on demand at willag.org. It is public radio for the farming world.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
We're now joined by Jackie Vick. She's with Stuart Peterson to take up the marketplace. Good afternoon to you, Jackie. I want to start with the support and resistance levels because I bet, given the moves in the last week, that things have changed just a little bit. Where do we stand today?
They definitely have. On May, we've got support at 361, 330, and then 311. And we're not that far from 361, to be honest. Resistance, 380. $4 and $4.10. These are monthly numbers. July, $3.70 for support, $3.41, and then $3.23. And resistance, $3.87.5, $4.07, and $4.27. I honestly believe that, you know, when you look at the ranges are very well defined in terms of the from at the moment anyway, from the 370 to about the 430 level. In a lot of these cases, 360 to the 410 or 420 level in May. You look at beans, support is at 875 in May, 853 and 776, and resistance 928, 952 and 976. And we look at July beans, we've got 908 for support, 864, and then again the dreaded $7 number, 792. Resistance 935. 957 and 980. So I think that, you know, these are numbers that you have to keep in mind. If we get close to some of these numbers and you haven't pulled a trigger or you haven't done anything in marketing, you need to definitely be doing something.
You know, this week, members of Congress have been briefed by U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer about the negotiations with China. And while those are still ongoing, and he says we're in the final weeks, it's given maybe a little time for everybody to think about what these economies look like, the United States and China. I take it there are some numbers that are coming out of China that are pretty interesting and continue to come maybe all week long. Is that right?
They are. You know, they're going to start releasing more tomorrow on Thursday, basically. And Bloomberg did, in Bloomberg Weekly, they did have the GDP numbers for last year. They had a, now this is interesting because people whine, you know, that their economy is slowing over in China. They were at 6.6% on GDP. Wouldn't we jump up and down for a 6% or 4%? And the forecast was 6.5%. I remember a year ago at this time, they were all saying they're never going to make it. It's not going to happen. And they did. They're employing 775.6 million people. Now, the interesting part about that, Todd, is that the urban employment is 434.2 million, or million people. And that's almost 10 million more than a year before in 2017. And, you know, this is one of the things that's fueling the growth in their economy is because they have somewhat of a plan to bring people in out of the country into the city. That's why you see some of the subsidizing that goes on at the farm level in China, because they don't want them all coming to town. You know, that you, no matter how poor the information system is, people still find out where the best money is to be made. And so I thought that that was interesting. They also seem to have stabilized their where their GDP is coming from. You know, they used to be heavily involved in the service sector. Now that only 59.7% of that GDP came out of service and 76.2% came out of consumption. So consumption has jumped dramatically. And that, too, has been impacted by the urban movement into the city. Their trade last year, $4.5 trillion, was a record high. And the interesting part there is that 13.3% of that increase came out of the Silk Road and the Belt countries. And so, you know, they've been working hard to try and get that back into the picture. And obviously it's working. Now, you know, you see a lot of people say, oh, you know, it's, you know, the Chinese economy is slowing. It's just going to kill everybody here in the U.S. And it's, and I've heard a lot of crazy things. But, you know, it, if it slows, what it really hurts is like the Australian and the New Zealand dollar, because China is their biggest trading partner. And, you know, the Canadian dollar will also be affected. It appears that it's going to have very little impact on the actual U.S. dollar itself, which is, you know, a plus for us. And so, you know, it'll be interesting. You know, you talked about the trade situation. We heard today that there are, quote unquote, strong rumors that China may buy some corn out of the Pacific Northwest. And of course, didn't help corn a whole lot. You know, nowadays we're happy to see a penny or two pennies up. You know, it seems like a really big move, but it's encouraging. You know, the Pacific Northwest is one of the issues that we certainly have to deal with here in the U.S. That was such a big port for beans. And it's just good to see things going out of there.
Yeah, speaking of that, it reminds me that acreage report is due out in a bit more than 2 weeks now, and we'll be watching what those numbers look like that feed the Pacific Northwest, the states, the Dakotas and Minnesota. What do we know about acreage and some of the numbers that have been coming out from the industry this week?
Well, the two that I've seen are Allendale and Informa, which is now called IEG Vantage. Basically, when they're kind of on the, well, they're somewhat in agreement on corn. Allendale came out at 91.5 million acres. IEG came out at 91.8, and the USDA Forum said 92 million acres. So they're pretty close on corn. On beans, that's just a little different. You see Allendale down at 84.3, and IEG at 85.5, with the USDA being at 85 million acres, you know, and so that is basically, one is higher on bean acreage, one is lower on bean acreage. Now, the thing that I know from attending the forum all these years and doing this for a long time is that these numbers that come out on these acreage reports and all of these guesses that come out of the USDA forum are always short on total acres. There's no question about that. And if you look at last year's, we had 226.1 million acres here in the U.S., between corn, bean, and wheat. And this year so far, we've only seen projections of 224. So we got a couple million acres that are, you know, they always leave a little bit in there because, you know, even until we get into the planting time, we're not totally certain what we're going to do. A lot of it depends on weather. And so we'll see what comes out, Todd, in 2 weeks on Friday the 29th. And so it'll be interesting to see. I myself kind of vote for the side that we're not going to take as many bean acres away, just somewhat because of financial, somewhat because of in the three eyes, at least, we're not going to see it happen. I think you're right. You know, when you talk about the Pacific Northwest, that's where I think the biggest changes could come in the outside states.
And finally, EPA released a rule yesterday that would allow at least a proposal, E15, in the summer gasoline supplies.
Yeah, they did. And I mean, I was very happy to see it come out. I can tell you that Big Oil is not happy because, you know, the summertime is the highest driving time, and this allows us to put a higher blend of ethanol in, which cuts back on how much, you know, how much gasoline is actually being used. So we'll see how big the boxing gloves are that Big Oil has on to be able to beat the EPA down. But I do believe that I think it's going to go through at some point in time. How much it'll be changed, I have no idea.
Hey, thanks so much.
Thank you, Todd. Have a great day.
Jackie Vexes with Stuart Peterson joins us here on the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. Find her comments online at willag.org, willag.org. And today you'll also find the newsletter that I sent out last night as it relates to the crop insurance decisions you're making. Gary Schnitke, agricultural economist from the University of Illinois, has written a new article for the FarmDoc Daily website. It's at farmdocdaily.illinois.edu. But the whole of the article is on our website at willag.org or in your email if you happen to subscribe to our newsletter. It explains the SCO decision and how it is decoupled And I saw this in confirmation from the United States Department of Agriculture again today, how it is decoupled from the actual ARC and PLC decision. Here's how you might think about this. It's a possibility to turn your crop insurance decision into a bit of a cost savings vehicle where you can use SCO instead of buying up, for instance, the RP. You can go down to maybe an 80 or 75% and fill out with SCO and not have an impact on your actual ARC PLC decision. I know that it's going to say it does. I know it sounds like it does, but think of it this way. The payments, if there is one, from crop insurance come this fall. That's what you're deciding about on crop insurance today. The ARC PLC payments, which you probably won't actually sign up for until maybe the spring of next year, are the payments for the 2019 crop, the one you're about to put in the ground, that would come not until the fall of 2020. So one's crop insurance payments, one is a farm safety net payment, and for this 1 year, 2019, they'll be decoupled. And I saw this again today in a USDA email, this one to Gary Schnitke, that said, yeah, they're decoupled. I still think there's a possibility it can be challenged, but know that you have from USDA the go-ahead to do that at this point. One last note, I'll be in LaSalle County tonight with the LaSalle County Farm Bureau and the LaSalle County Stockman. We can talk about it again then if you'd like. In today's agricultural news, U.S. EPA has proposed a rule that would allow E15 in the nation's gasoline supply this summer. Jeff Cooper, president and CEO of the Renewable Fuels Association, is happy with the proposal, but worried time will run out before the proposal can become rule.
Yesterday's proposal began a public comment process. That period is 45 days long. It ends on April 29th. So EPA basically will have the month of May to read and synthesize probably tens of thousands of comments they get from the public, write the final rule, get that final rule through White House review, and oh, by the way, there's a Memorial Day, holiday in there. So getting all of that done in 30 days in the month of May is going to be a very challenging task for EPA. We remain hopeful they'll get it done. Honestly, this proposal got through the White House review quicker than we thought it would. It was only there for a week or less, so that's encouraging, and it's clear that they have hit warp speed with this rule and made it a top priority. So we're hoping it gets done. Fingers crossed.
Cooper made his comments this morning on the Adams on Agriculture radio program from the American Ag Radio Network. University of Illinois Ag economist Scott Irwin's initial read of the proposal pointed out that the RVP waiver used to incorporate E15 asked for comments on the liability of pumping E15 into vehicles not designed to use it. This would include most vehicles produced prior to 2001. It did not suggest a rule on this point that could be a non-starter for the gasoline stations or regulate E15 to blender pumps where it is already available. The proposal would allow those pumps to include E15 during the summer months. Let's move from ethanol policy to trade policy. U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer was to meet this morning with the entire House Democratic Caucus to try to continue to build bipartisan support for USMCA. But the wooing probably wasn't all that easy, as several of the party's progressive members have said they have a lot of problems with the way the deal was written. House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer said Tuesday there has not been broad discussion on the issue at this point in time because, frankly, the administration hasn't been doing much. But he thinks that more talks with Lighthizer will come. The concerns could also ramp up pressure on House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who holds major leverage over the deal's fate. Pelosi hasn't yet staked out a public position. Let's stay with trade for just a moment. Washington and Brussels have reached an agreement in principle to guarantee U.S. farmers a set portion of the EU's annual 45,000-ton quota for hormone-free beef imports. The EU set up the annual import quota in 2009 after losing a WTO dispute over its ban on hormone-treated beef, but major beef exporting competitors like Australia and Uruguay quickly took up large portions of the quota, crowding out U.S. producers. Negotiations started in September to address complaints from the U.S. beef industry. And finally today, the Agriculture Department released its middle list of 67 potential sites for two ag research agencies that Secretary Sonny Perdue has proposed moving out of the Beltway. USDA is aiming to select a final location by the end of May. Illinois has 9 potential locations remaining on USDA's middle list, followed by Virginia with 8, Ohio with 6, and Iowa with 5. A total of 28 states still have sites in the running. Well, on this Wednesday afternoon, we're now joined by Rich Nelson. He's the chief strategist at Allendale out of McHenry, Illinois. Allendale has just completed, and Rich will have been the primary behind putting these numbers together, its survey of farmers to take a look at acreage across the United States prior to the prospective plantings report being released on the 29th of this month. Rich, thanks so much for joining us. Tell me about this survey.
So we've been doing this for over 25 years. This is our annual acreage survey of producers across the nation. This year's survey covered 29 separate states. We had enough valid surveys to cover 12 of them, which the core 12 states give us about 83% of all acreage. In terms of overall findings, biggest issue for us is maybe lower than USDA numbers as far as acreage for corn and soybeans, maybe a slight bump up on the wheat side versus USDA in February.
Did you get enough information, and I'm going to start broadly and then work our way down, about total acreage in the U.S. to get an idea whether crop acreage will be down across the United States in general or not?
You know, we just got enough information to do, like I said, the main 12 states as far as the main 12 in the Midwest here. And of this, corn, soybean, and wheat numbers, and as a reminder, this is not a sorghum or cotton or other crops survey. Of those 12 separate states, we did see a net decline versus last year, 223.2 million acres, and that's down almost 3 million acres from last year.
And give me some actual numbers for corn, soybeans, and wheat.
As far as the corn, it looks like 91.475 million acres. That would be, of course, an increase over last year, an increase of just about 2.3 million, and that would be a little under USDA's current guesstimate of 92. As far as soybeans, 84.263 million acres. That's maybe a sharper decline than we expected to see, down 4.9 from last year. And that's also a little lower than USDA's 85 posted last month. Over on the wheat end of things here, 47.414 million acres for all wheat combined, and that's down about 386,000 from last year. A little higher, though, than USDA last month.
Do you ask producers anything else in this survey beyond the acreage?
We certainly do. At this time of year, it's, of course, very interesting to find out how they're what's going on with their marketing patterns. And we did find, as far as corn, slightly lower than expected, lower than last year marketings. 63% of old crop has been sold at this point, based on our survey. That's down from last year's 65. Of interest, though, soybean marketing's quite a bit under last year. Only 72% sold by this time for the old crop. Looks like 85% was last year at this time. Key thing of interest for the soybean was actually the new crop numbers there. Only 11% sold versus last year's 29% by this point.
And what is your estimation of the markets at this time?
You know, for the most part, we are still suggesting this market is going to stay at a lower price range here as for the next couple of weeks. We do see some concern about the moisture situation, and we do expect some acreage to be cut back because of that. The key issue for us is when the market's going to recognize that issue.
Anything that you're watching in particular in the next week or 2 weeks beyond the acreage report, the stocks numbers that are coming out from USDA?
You know, of course, we can look at trade talks being the primary issue we're all kind of discussing right now. Of secondary concern, we will be watching these forecasts very closely. We, of course, have a very heavy rain system lined up right now in the very short term. The two-week forecast, though, as it stands, still calls for below normal moisture. We would suggest that if or when that does change, and when we do expect it to change according to our meteorologists we follow, that we expect that maybe by this month we can start discussing a little upside movement there.
Thanks so much, Rich.
Happy to help. Thank you so much.
That's Rich Nelson. He is the chief strategist at Allendale out of McHenry, Illinois. You're listening to the Closing Market Report for this Wednesday afternoon. Drew Lerner is here from World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City. It's a big, nasty storm making its way across the High Plains and into the Dakotas, maybe, I suppose, through Minnesota. Can you tell me about it, please?
Yeah, so we are in the midst of seeing this low-pressure system just dropping like a bomb, as they call it out there. The deepening low-pressure system is over eastern Colorado right now. We are seeing the first of the snow beginning to show up in western Nebraska and southwestern South Dakota. So far, the snowfall rates have just recently become heavy in localized areas, but we haven't really seen the storm kick in greatly yet. Increasing wind speeds are common throughout the central and southern plains, though, at this hour. The speeds sustained at 30 to 40 miles per hour, and we're getting a few gusts now up to around 50. So it is going to become more and more of a significant event as we go through the afternoon and the evening. It will move, the storm center will move from Colorado into eastern Nebraska, and then all that will occur during the next 12 to 24 hours, and then we'll move to the Great Lakes region shortly after that. Storm's going to be very intense. The snow is going to expand greatly in the next 8 to 10 hours and spread very quickly from eastern Colorado and western Nebraska through most of South Dakota except extreme east, and then moving into North Dakota and parts of Manitoba, Canada, as well as northwestern Minnesota as we get into the night tonight. Snow accumulations are going to run from 5 to 12 inches. There's going to be 12 to 17 inches probably in central South Dakota and back across the Nebraska border into some areas of the panhandle. And we will see some areas in southeastern Wyoming and northeastern Colorado just a little bit less than what I just described. But all of that region is going to be impacted greatly. Travel is going to be terrible. Livestock stress is probably going to be the worst it's been this season. And with calving that's underway, we're very concerned about some of the health of the animals and perhaps some losses will occur as the storm system matures. It will clear out of the way as we get into the morning tomorrow, but it will take most of the day tomorrow for conditions to settle down a little bit. So it's really Friday that we'll start seeing the biggest move to cleaning up after the storm.
This isn't a dry snow either. It's a big, heavy, wet one, right?
That's correct. And a lot of weight for the livestock to have to carry. The wind is going to drive that snow into the animals and get stuck in their fur and allow for the accumulation on their backs to be fairly significant. Of course, it'll be accumulating around their feet as well. Eventually, the weight of that snow on their backs is going to become very stressful, and there may be a tendency for these animals to want to lay down, and if that happens, then they may not be able to get back up, and the snow will continue to pile up around them. So there is the risk that these animals will suffer some pretty horrendous conditions. It may not be a widespread, serious like what I just described, but I do expect some serious problems out there.
Thanks so much. I appreciate you taking the time with us today and keeping an eye on the weather.
All right. You have a good day.
You too. That is Drew Lerner. He is with World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City. I'm Todd Gleason.